If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to Life of the Week from History Extra, where leading historians delve into the lives of history's most intriguing and significant figures. David Lloyd George is a name that frequently features in lists of Britain's greatest prime ministers. Born in Manchester and raised in rural Wales, the Liberal luminary helped to lay the foundations of the modern welfare state, and went on to lead the nation during the final 2 years of the First World War. But there's far more to Lloyd George's life and career, as Professor Richard Toy tells John Borkham in today's episode of our Life of the Week series.
Firstly, Richard, thanks for joining me on the History Extra podcast.
My pleasure.
Now, today we're going to be talking about the life of David Lloyd George. But before we get properly started, I just wondered whether you could give us just a very, very brief summary. Who was he in a nutshell?
Well, he was Liberal Prime Minister of Britain between 1916 and 1922. He had a reputation as the man who won the war, somebody who came in at a crucial moment of World War I and was in charge when Britain achieved victory. He subsequently fell from power and became rather discredited, although he remained active in politics virtually until the end of his life when he died in 1945.
Great. Now, that's an excellent summary. And of course, we'll delve into some of those aspects in detail later. What can you tell us about his early life and his upbringing?
Well, he was perhaps the most famous Welshman of the 20th century, but he was actually born in Manchester in 1863 and moved to Wales at a young age. His father died when he was young. He was brought up by his mother, but very much with the sort of the help and encouragement of his uncle, her brother, who was a kind of a key figure in David Lloyd George's early life. And so Uncle Lloyd, he was referred to, was a shoemaker in North Wales. And so David Lloyd George, he kind of grew up bilingual, Welsh and English, and was somebody who certainly liked to talk very much about his humble origins, who wanted to make use of that politically. And of course, it's perfectly true that by comparison with many of the aristocratic figures who had risen high in politics in the 18th and 19th century and earlier on, of course, he was, relatively speaking, humble, but he wasn't somebody who was deprived. Certainly, after his father died, there were immediate financial problems, but he was somebody who his uncle, who I've mentioned, was a master craftsman, therefore somebody who was earning well, could have a comfortable lifestyle. And this allowed David to be trained as a solicitor. And obviously the legal profession was, again, something which it wasn't a guarantee of success. You had to work hard, you had to know what you're doing, and you had to have perhaps a certain amount of luck. But clearly that was one of the professions which was going to give you a good start and plenty of opportunities in life.
Indeed. And how did he first get involved in politics directly? Because I think he joins the Liberal Club locally, doesn't he?
He is very much involved in Liberal politics. I mean, he, at the age of 18 or 19, visits the House of Commons and sits in the gallery and sort of says, I saw this as my domain of where I would subsequently become the master. So he's very ambitious from a young age. He comes to prominence locally through his legal career because he represents a nonconformist family in a famous burial case where the Anglican vicar, this was one of the great causes of Welsh politics, the dislike of the established church by many people. And the Anglican vicar refused this particular family the right to bury their family member according to nonconformist rites in an Anglican churchyard, and they kind of take the law into their own hands. They break in and they bury the person themselves. And this sort of leads to a court case, which after a long legal battle, finally on appeal, they win. And with Lloyd George as their solicitor, that obviously brings him, you know, a good degree of kudos. And he's adopted as Liberal candidate for Carnarvon Boroughs. And when the Conservative MP for that constituency dies in 1890, Lloyd George fights the by-election and narrowly wins by 18 votes. Obviously, a very small margin, but remembering, of course, that not everybody was enfranchised, and so that the numbers of voters, the electorate was smaller in those days.
And he is in Parliament for, I think it's 9 years, and he really comes to prominence following the outbreak of the Second Boer War, which he staunchly opposes.
Right.
How did his stance on that affect his political standing?
Well, of course, this was a key lightning rod issue, if you like. It was kind of a where you stood on this issue was a good indicator of where you stood on the political spectrum more broadly. And of course, it was, in general, a popular war where there was a great deal of jingoism and patriotism. So it took a fair amount of political courage to oppose it. And it was an imperial war. Lloyd George wasn't opposed to the empire as a whole. Rather, it was kind of a bit like the sort of Barack Obama line about Iraq. You know, I don't oppose wars, I oppose dumb wars. And so there was a sense that, you know, the Boers, who were, you know, white people of Dutch descent in South Africa, that they were being bullied, if you like, by the British Empire. They sort of fitted into the narrative, you know, the liberal narrative of small nations and the rights of small nations, and the idea that their resistance needed to be recognized or acknowledged. Of course, they were really white supremacists, it should be mentioned, as of course were a lot of people in the British Empire as well. So again, it was a war between two really quite unappealing ideologies, if you like. But nevertheless, Lloyd George opposes the war, puts himself at, you know, personal risk. I mean, we think a lot about people on Twitter receiving death threats, but certainly this is nothing new in politics, that he was putting himself in physical danger by going into places like Birmingham, which were hotbeds of support for the war, and standing up and making speeches against him, and, you know, with sort of riots and disruption breaking out. So, I mean, I guess what is interesting is that this doesn't permanently marginalize him from any chances of political success in the future. And that although the Liberal Party sort of splits or divides over that issue, it doesn't formally split, but has different groups within it, so-called pro-Boers like Lloyd George, and the Liberal Imperialists, people like Asquith and Rosebery, and people who sat in the middle like Henry Campbell Bannerman, the party's leader. So once the war is over, the party is able to reunite to a considerable degree, particularly when almost immediately afterwards, in 1903, this controversy about free trade versus protectionism breaks out, led by Joseph Chamberlain, the colonial secretary in the Conservative / Liberal Unionist government, who is advocating for imperial tariffs. And this succeeds in uniting the Liberal Party around the issue of the traditional cause of free trade. And so when the Conservative government resigns in 1905, a new Liberal government is formed, Lloyd George is somebody who's positioned himself quite well not to be, you know, absolutely at the top of the table, the cabinet table, if you like, but certainly quite prominent. And he gets this role as president of the Board of Trade as his first government job, a cabinet position.
Yes, in that position as president of the Board of Trade, what are his main achievements?
Well, I mean, the key achievements are really on things where you wouldn't perhaps today think, well, this was kind of a foundational issue in politics. There was a Patents Act, there was a Port of London Authority Act, none of which seem immensely politically salient from a modern perspective. But really the point was that he'd taken a cabinet position or a government department, which had maybe been perceived as a bit of a backwater somewhere you can put somebody who you want to sort of keep out of trouble, if you like, give them, acknowledge them by giving them a role, but thinking, well, they're not really necessarily going to have very much to do. And by being a kind of activist cabinet minister who sort of insists on passing legislation and getting things done, he really not only raises his own profile and creates the situation where he is a logical candidate for becoming Chancellor of the Exchequer when Campbell Bannerman, the Prime Minister, resigns through ill health in 1908. He has also laid the groundwork for this sort of more activist style of politics. And so the particular achievements, which legislative achievements, which we associate with him and the Liberal government more generally, are old age pensions, although a lot of the work on that had actually been done by H.H. Asquith when he had been the Chancellor of the Exchequer. So Lloyd George was really just implementing in 1908 what had pretty much already been decided.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Absolutely. Of course, yeah, in 1909, it sort of crystallized in this famous People's Budget. What was the public reaction to these proposals? And what sort of crisis did it spark within the Lords?
Well, of course, in the absence of opinion polling, it's a bit difficult to say exactly what public reaction was. There is kind of debate about whether there really was a large-scale popular demand for this type of welfare provision. It's certainly the Boer War, which we mentioned earlier, has made these issues even more prominent, because when the recruits come forward, people volunteering, wanting to go into the army, an awful lot of them, around a third of them, are rejected on the grounds that they're not sufficiently physically fit. So there was a dimension to this which was not only about being beneficent to the population in general, but it was about trying to maintain the strength of the empire by making sure that the physical manpower was there at a sufficiently efficient level. Now, of course, these proposals, this People's Budget, which you mentioned, which does dramatically increase taxes, which are required not only to pay for welfare, but for naval rearmament against the growing perceived threat of Germany. It was clear that in a period where the government had rather lost its way in the early years and had difficulty and struggled to find an agenda, Lloyd George's idea was that if you put up a radical, with a kind of capital R, set of proposals and sort of challenged the House of Lords, which still had the power of veto, then if the Lords fell into the trap of vetoing what Lloyd George thought was going to be a popular set of proposals, then you could go to an election on the slogan, the peers versus the people, you know, kind of the many versus the few. And therefore, that was a potentially good way of mobilizing popular opinion on the side of the Liberals. We don't really know for certain whether Lloyd George framed his proposals deliberately to make the Lords veto them, but it was a kind of a win-win situation, because either you got your proposals through or you set up this big battle where you could, in an almost sort of populist way, if you like, cast yourself as being the representative, the tribune of the people versus the elite. And so in terms of popularity, we can, of course, see that Lloyd George was holding, and others were holding, mass meetings to which there was certainly huge attendance. He did become, you know, to many, a popular hero. But at the same time, of course, he alienated many other people as well. And, of course, he made good jokes about the House of Lords being 500 men chosen randomly from among the ranks of the unemployed and so forth. And he was a marvelous orator. He had a great knack with crowds. But of course, you could also see that this kind of risk of alienating quite a lot of people when the elections, there are actually two elections that take place in 1910. And in terms of the number of seats that both Conservatives and the Liberals win, Well, the Conservatives really do recover from 1906, the Liberal landslide in those years. And in terms of those seats, the direct comparison between Liberals and Conservatives, it's pretty much a draw, suggesting that the Liberals have actually lost support. However, the balance of power is held by the Labour Party, which had first got a significant number of seats, around 30 in 1906, and kind of increased that to about 40 in 1910. And the Irish Parliamentary Party, this is a crucial fact, that the entire of Ireland was still part of the United Kingdom and was sending a large number of nationalist MPs who would be, in general, inclined to support the Liberals to the Westminster Parliament, and that therefore, between them, although the Liberals have only got the same number of MPs as the Conservatives, they can fairly reliably trust the Labour Party and the Irish Parliamentary Party to back them and keep them in office.
And aside from the social reforms that you mentioned, he is, of course, best known for what he did during the First World War. What was his reaction to the outbreak of that conflict? Because, of course, this was a man who had, as you said, became famous for his opposition to the Boer War.
Well, essentially, we should mention somebody who's got a reputation of being quite devious. He is somebody who also is sort of still had the reputation of being on the radical side of the party. That's not necessarily left-wing in the sense that we would understand it, of necessarily being in favor of a particularly large state. He had many conventional opinions around, as we mentioned, for example, you know, the British Empire. But at the same time, he was the standard bearer of the left within the cabinet. And equally, he was expected to be somebody who would be skeptical of British involvement in a European war. And so really what happens is that he's kind of put in this position where he maybe be expected by a large number of people to kind of lead the opposition to the war, and has to find a way to appear to be true to those people and to those values without actually putting himself out on a limb. And I don't think he ever seriously wants to resign from the cabinet. And really, it is the crucial issue of the fact that the Germans invade neutral Belgium, which gives Lloyd George and indeed many other people, if you like, you could call it a justification or you could call it an excuse to support the war, because again, Belgium, a nation which actually has got its own massive empire in Africa and is acting in an incredibly oppressive way against the population of the Congo, for example, nevertheless is presented as one of these small nations on which Liberals are so fond of supporting their rights. And so that when you put it in this frame of the Germans trampling over this plucky little Belgium, then that gives Lloyd George and many of his supporters, although not all of them, this cover, if you like, to move to supporting what is really a kind of a fairly conventional great power conflict.
And then, of course, a coalition forms in 1915, doesn't it? And Lloyd George is appointed Minister of Munitions. What role does he play in solving the shell crisis, which is obviously this huge shortage of ammunition?
Yes, which has provoked a political crisis, which has contributed to the creation of the coalition as well. So I guess that Lloyd George's contribution is that he takes a political risk by accepting this position, that he comes in, he is very dynamic, he brings in entrepreneurs, businessmen, the ones who he refers to as men of push and go, to try and solve the logjam, to get Whitehall working, but in combination of using state activity and creating new state factories and getting the most out of private entrepreneurship and private enterprise. And so he certainly makes a big contribution. These problems which have plagued the British Army on the Western Front in the first part of 1915 don't really recur, although, of course, there are all sorts of other problems that do. Of course, his possible to exaggerate. And of course, he tried to maybe exaggerate in his memoirs the degree to which this was a total revolution rather than being based on some things which had already been done before he took over. But certainly he is a brilliant PR spokesman who both manages to make it seem like the government is being more energetic, but also present himself as being the key person who is bringing that energy, which again brings him great political advantages later on.
And talking of political advantages, well, I mean, it's triggered by the death of Lord Kitchener, obviously, in 1916. He briefly becomes Secretary of State for War and then, of course, Prime Minister towards the end of that year. Could you just briefly explain the circumstances in which he became Prime Minister and why Asquith resigned?
Yeah. So Asquith was a great peacetime Prime Minister who was very good at balancing different factions and crisis management. But as a war leader, he became perceived as somebody who was sort of presiding rather than actively taking decisions, which caused a lot of frustration. Of course, there was frustration amongst conservatives. There were debates over conscription, for example. From the traditional liberal perspective, conscription was kind of a no-go because it was interfering with the freedom of the individual. It was arguably necessary or to have a chance of achieving victory. And so sort of Asquith's approach to this is rather than sort of coming out clearly and saying, yes, I will support conscription and sort of giving a lead on that, it's rather to move by kind of crab-like stages by having a particular scheme called the Derby Scheme, which involves people stating their willingness in the future to come forward. And sort of, you know, waiting for these other expedients to fail before saying, okay, now we need to act. So there's this general sense, not necessarily completely just or fair to Asquith, but the sort of maybe a public perception, but also perception within Westminster that he's just insufficiently decisive to actually get action. Now, there is a series of maneuvers in the autumn of 1916 which revolve around, you know, for example, what would seem fairly obscure, the question of dispersal of enemy war surplus property in Nigeria. Don't think they would get anybody terribly motivated to argue about that as such, but when large numbers of MPs vote against the government on that issue, is really a symbol of their discontent. And so what it's really about is whether or not Asquith will allow other people to create a more dynamic war council. And the ultimate proposal is that Asquith himself should actually not be a member of that war council, which he sees as being unacceptable. He tries to do a maneuver, sort of seeing himself as maybe indispensable, offers his resignation to the king in the expectation that nobody else will be able to form a government and that therefore he'll be called back. And again, after various twists and turns, it is Lloyd George who emerges really as the natural successor, as the only person who can really command confidence. And of course, this is a remarkable turnaround, given that he was the radical former pro-Boer who had been perceived as a class warrior and was, you know, sort of been hated by many conservatives. And so he, because the Liberal Party then really sort of splits in, at least in a kind of an informal way, in between the supporters of Asquith and the supporters of Lloyd George, Lloyd George ends up in this position where he is the Prime Minister, but without actually commanding a majority in the House of Commons in his own right, and therefore being reliant on Conservative votes in order to get his measures through. So, in fact, during the war, this is not really a big issue for him, although Asquith, there's always this threat that Asquith might manage to bring about a confidence vote and somehow overturn Lloyd George in turn. So his position isn't completely secure, yet he does have this, certainly got this organizational ability. He has this popular touch. He doesn't necessarily manage the generals very well. He certainly feels that he's being frustrated in that sphere, but he's sufficiently strong that his relative weakness in terms of the MPs who support him actually during the lifetime of the war is not a big problem.
But nevertheless, the war is won. What is his role at the Paris Peace Conference?
Well, it's absolutely fundamental as one of the so-called big four of leaders of Britain, France, the United States, and Italy. And again, with, of course, plenty of justice, there are many criticisms which are made of the settlement, which was arrived at in Paris and signed at Versailles, as sort of an enormous, capacious attempt to solve all of Europe's problems at the same time. In fact, ending up in various ways creating many new problems. And remember, this actually involved him for a long period of time, for about 6 months. I mean, it kept coming back occasionally, but essentially decamping to Paris and contributing on a day-to-day basis on a very detailed way to the negotiations, whilst still, of course, being responsible for government in England. Technology was quite good. There was telegraphs. You could get in a plane and you could travel back. You know, even if you just went on the train and the boat, it was still a relatively quick journey. But it was nevertheless sort of quite a remarkable thing to have the Prime Minister out of the country for such a long period.
Right, okay. And as we talk about this post-war period, we should probably address the so-called coupon election of 1918, because this wartime coalition continues beyond the armistice. Could you just give us a brief summary of what that was?
At the 1918 election, the Conservatives under Andrew Bonar-Law and the coalition Liberals under Lloyd George decided to fight on a joint coalition programme, in other words, having a joint manifesto. And also, this involved them deciding which parliamentary candidates they were going to jointly endorse. And so when they decided on that list, they sent the candidates who they wanted to support a telegram saying, "We are backing you," and signing their joint names. And so Asquith, who was fighting against them, leading the independent group of Liberals, derisively referred to this in the context of rationing as being similar to a ration coupon. And so this is why it got the nickname the coupon election.
That's a great explanation. And this coalition, as I said, it continues, but there are numerous problems they have to contend with, not least numerous economic woes. What is David Lloyd George's solution to tackling those problems?
Well, I suppose the first thing it's worth mentioning is that there was a brief post-war boom, which then in the summer of 1920 kind of turns into a situation where there's high and growing unemployment. And this does very quickly become a salient political issue, but the government does not really have any concrete solutions other than really hoping that things are going to get better. And that this kind of brings the fault lines in the coalition to the fore, insofar as part of the promise of the 19 election had been for restoration and renewal, and then very famously Homes for Heroes, so a significant house building program. And the reaction of the Conservatives really to economic problems is to implement what we would now refer to as a kind of austerity, so welfare cutbacks. And that then means that the plans for social reform, which had been flagged up in 1918, really fall victim to this kind of public spending axe. And that is not the only factor which undermines the coalition, but certainly it is a very significant one.
Of course, and we can't really talk about David Lloyd George without talking about the scandals that he was involved in. There is also this honours scandal playing out around the same time, isn't there? What was the impact of that?
Well, as he mentioned, scandal, or sometimes things which might be thought scandalous, which didn't come to light. You know, we should, of course, just briefly go back to the pre-war period. The one which was very much discussed was the Marconi scandal, a kind of insider trader scandal in which Lloyd George and other government ministers were implicated, but were never actually forced to resign. Then there was the fact that Lloyd George, although married for decades, was seriously unfaithful to his wife, Margaret. And also for decades, starting in the pre-war period, effectively started living with his secretary, Francis Stevenson, which again was sort of known in political circles, but didn't come to light. So what was considered scandalous or what was thought appropriate for the press to comment on was sort of different in those days. But to return to the honour scandal, well, essentially this was partly a product of Lloyd George's precarious political position, insofar as he sort of had his own party, the Coalition Liberals, but the Liberal Party as a whole was divided between him and Asquith. So what he wanted to do was to try and build up his own political machine, and that lacking sources of funding, one way to raise money was to essentially hand out honours, knighthoods, peerages, and so forth in exchange for donations to his party funds, to the Lloyd George Fund. Now, actually, at the time, it wasn't illegal. So he wasn't breaking any laws. And in fact, basically, the Conservatives did it as well. I mean, this was a fairly well-established political practice. But the reason that Lloyd George really annoyed the Conservatives over this was that he was selling to peerages to people who they really thought they should be selling peerages to, and they should be getting the money. And so this is, again, something which becomes publicly known in sort of mid-summer of 1922. And again, it's not the factor which brings about the fall of his government, but it does add to this air of scandal. I think one of his flaws is that he's too interested in the European diplomacy. He likes to go off and play golf in the south of France with the French Prime Minister and so on. We're taking him away from the House of Commons, where he can sort of do the day-to-day political management. So he's kind of neglectful of Parliament, which ultimately counts against him. But at the end of the day, it is not a scandal as such, but a new crisis when there is a situation where war with Turkey seems to threaten, and Lloyd George is suspected, along with Churchill, who is still his colleague as a coalition liberal at this stage, of being warmongers and of manipulating this crisis, or we are wanting to have a new war in order to be able to stay in office when that otherwise might not be possible.
And of course, eventually he resigns as Prime Minister in 1922. What was his impact on politics in the 1920s and 1930s? Because of course, he becomes leader of the Liberals in 1926. Was he still a political force, or was he sidelined?
Well, I think you could say both in a way, insofar as he remains a major player. As you say, he loses office in 1922 when the bulk of the Conservative Party in Parliament withdraw their support from the coalition, which leads to the creation of a purely Conservative government under Bonar Law. And people think, well, you know, this is temporary. Lloyd George will be back. And indeed, there are certain moments where that looks perhaps not completely out of the question. So that in 1923, when again the Conservatives raise the issue or go call an election in trying to get support for tariff reform or protectionism, actually this brings the Liberal Party back together. Asquith and Lloyd George actually reunite within a few years after that. Lloyd George manages to squeeze Asquith out and be sort of again the sole leader of the Liberal Party. And in 1929, he fights on a program of We Can Conquer Unemployment, so a big program of public works, kind of proto-Keynesian solutions, as we might call them. And people think, actually, he could be in contention. In fact, the Liberals in 1929 only get 59 seats, which is obviously nowhere near enough to actually form a government. But certainly he was, you know, sort of up to that point, conceivably in the next couple of years as well. Until, you know, 1931, the Liberal Party really gets smashed in an even bigger way. He's still a potential player. And even at a point in 1940, where he really doesn't have a party any longer, the only people who are loyal to him are basically MPs who are members of his own family, either directly or through marriage. And he's not got a party. And yet he's actually discussed seriously by some people as a potential prime minister at the point where Neville Chamberlain resigns in May after the Norwegian crisis. And so I don't really think that was ever a runner, but it's kind of remarkable that he should still have been discussed by anybody in those terms so long after he'd fallen from office. And I think that ultimately is a tribute to people's continued belief in his ability on the basis of his record in World War One.
Indeed. But what about his views on Hitler and the Nazis during the 1930s?
Yes, well, he was very foolish, really, in sort of going to meet Hitler in 1936 and then lavishing praise on him. I mean, he subsequently shifted his opinion and opposed the Munich Agreement, for example. But again, in the autumn of 1939, after war has broken out and it's not clear how Britain can really win, he comes out in favour of a compromise peace, and certainly being rather a vain and egotistical person, he's sort of flooded with letters from members of the public in support, and he's very pleased with himself at this stage. So he was somebody who, certainly as he got older, his judgment did decline, and the criticism that he was more interested in self-promotion and was very vain, I think is really a fair criticism that was made of him at that stage, although that shouldn't necessarily be taken as something which should reflect on him earlier in his career in the same way.
And he dies in 1945, shortly before the end of the Second World War. What was the public reaction to his death?
Well, maybe worth mentioning that by this stage, he'd just very briefly before sort of taken a peerage. So he'd been a member of the House of Commons since 1890. I guess the last election which he contested was 1935 because there wasn't a wartime general election. But of course, that's a remarkably long time and a, you know, sort of a tribute to his ability. Of course, it was a very strong liberal area that he came from. But a contrast, for example, to Churchill, who was also a member of the House of Commons for even longer a number of decades, but he kept losing constituencies at various times. So, you know, and lost by-elections, whereas Lloyd George was all the way through. So that was sort of a tribute to his understanding, if you like, of his own constituency. I think when he died, again, there was obviously sadness. There were people who had been loyal liberals for decades who appreciated his contribution. But it wasn't really a sort of a national event in the same way that Churchill's funeral was 20 years later, for example. So I think that he was somebody who was probably recognized as sort of having had his time and his moment in the sun, and maybe people were a little surprised that he was still alive at that stage, really.
And so finally, Richard, how do you think he should be remembered?
Well, I think that he deserves to be remembered as one of the greatest prime ministers of the 20th century, perhaps of all time, because of his remaking or contribution to the remaking of the state and the reforming of how government was done, and in order to make it more efficient, the expansion of the state during wartime. These were all important things which had consequences for peacetime as well. I think that there are some likable things about him, that he was obviously, as I mentioned, a fantastic orator or rhetorician, but also there are many things about his character, particularly when you read about his later life from sort of people who saw him close up, which are really not attractive, where he appeared petty and vindictive and egotistical and so on. So I guess I would say that ultimately, although obviously people want to think about who was the greatest prime minister and kind of draw up lists, I don't think we should necessarily think about history in that way, and that therefore I would really rather just sort of place him in his context as somebody who was a very important transitional figure from an evolving Edwardian way of doing politics to a way of doing politics which is in some ways still recognisable in the kind of politics that we have today.
Professor Richard Toy, thanks very much for your time. Really good to talk to you.
Thank you.
That was Richard Toy, Professor of History at the University of Exeter. You can find plenty more Life of the Week episodes. Just search for them on your podcast feeds or our website, historyextra.com.